Welcome, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. The federal government is open for business, and the U.S. did not default on its debt obligations. That's the good news. We may see all of this over again, however, come January, and that's because the deal Congress reached only keeps the government funded through mid-January and only raises the debt limit through the first week of February. So are we likely to see this exact cycle again in less than half a year? Did the media coverage of this as a political battle help you understand the economic stakes, the political context, and the real effects of this manufactured crisis? It's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we want to know where you saw great reporting, what you think was missed, and how you're getting your news these days. So joining us to discuss all of this, we've got Michael McAuliffe, who's the senior congressional correspondent for the Huffington Post. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Do you getting to take a little bit of a break after covering all of this?
Yes, just a little bit.
Just a little.
But I'm in the office today.
And Kevin Hall is also joining us. He's the chief economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, and he's also in D.C. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, thanks for having us.
So as we always do on Fridays, we want to start by giving kudos to a journalist or an outlet that did a good job this week. Why don't we start with you, Kevin? Did a piece of reporting catch your attention?
Well, there were a lot of them, but I kind of chose a narrower one today. There was a nice piece that NBC's website had put out, kind of looking at the initiation of Medicare and Social Security and how they were met with the same sort of opposition and slander, for lack of a better word, that Obamacare or the ACA is today getting. And they have a nice photo of Ronald Reagan in 1961, who had actually recorded an album. Back then the LP was the MP3, and kind of an album diatribe against Medicare and how it was the end of all things free market. And of course, we know how that ended up.
And we'll put a link to that at yourcallradio.org. There's this photo of Ronald Reagan, and it's the album cover. It says, Ronald Reagan speaks out against socialized medicine, and that was against Social Security at the that was Medicaid, right, in 61?
Medicare, yeah.
Yeah, Medicare. And what that piece really talks about is that there were these same really partisan divisions and fights around those public programs as well.
Yeah, and that over time, people have come to embrace them, and perhaps the same could happen with the ACA.
Although they say that this fight over the ACA was actually more vicious than even those.
Because people in leadership actually opposed it versus further down the ranks, yes.
And what about you, Michael? What did you see this week that you thought was well done?
Well, I was pretty head down in all of this showdown, but there were two things that I saw today, actually, that I found interesting, that sort of put an interesting light on the whole debate. Now, one is just a local daily story out of the, I think it's the Salt Lake Trib, that looked at Mike Lee. He's one of the Tea Party senators from Utah who was right there with Ted Cruz and pushing this whole showdown. And it found that he raised an awful lot of money for a senator from Utah in an off year by touting this campaign fairly relentlessly, something like 13 or 14 fundraising emails throughout the showdown, added about almost $250,000 to his campaign account, which is a lot for this time of year out in Utah. Ted Cruz raised $1.2 million in the past 3 months, which was a huge jump from the last report. But the really interesting thing about this is when you get down to the bottom of the story, you find out that Mike Lee's approval rating dropped from 50% in June to 40% in the first week of October, and it's likely to have gone even lower since then. So it's an interesting piece because it sort of shows you what this sort of intense focus on something that really a minority of the people in this country wanted, a shutdown of the government. And why? Well, he was able to raise some money off of it, but it's cost him popularity, so I wonder if he'll be as determined next time around. And there's one other thing that I just wanted that I saw, and it's actually a bit of a social policy study, financial policy, actually, that maybe our other guests saw when it actually came out. But it's a study by four professors, one from NYU and some from around the world, that looks at the effect of the CARD Act, which was passed in 2009. The CARD Act, yes. And it makes credit card companies tell you when they're going to raise your rates. It eliminates certain late fees and things like that. It didn't get as much attention as Dodd-Frank and all of that, but the study looked at its effect since it went into effect, and it's saving consumers about $21 billion a year just by knowing what your what's actually going on with your credit. So I found those two things interesting because here you have this sort of angry fight from this from the right with a sort of anti-regulation, you know, anti-big government approach, and then you have here a piece of legislation that worked pretty well, and it's saving people a lot of money.
And we'll put a link to that at yourcallradio.org. You can also send us any links to articles or journalism that you thought was particularly well done by going by sending us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Did you also see that, Kevin?
I'm aware of the CARD Act and how it's worked. I did not see that actual report. But
and were you aware of the effect of $21 billion saved by consumers
because of
that?
It really restricted their ability to fees. I mean, this was a money center for banks, and it's forced them to, you know, it was a free money center because they didn't actually have to work for your business, and they could. Part of that was the overnight change of rates, too, for your outstanding balance. I mean, they used to be able to, if you had a change in your credit score, basically change the amount you owe on a balance already already run up. So it was pretty strange that they were able to do that, and it reined in a lot of the bad behavior.
And what year did the CARD Act pass?
I think 2009. Is that right?
Is that right, Michael?
Yeah, 2009.
2009. Well, let's move to another story. I wanted to get your reaction to the news that Glenn Greenwald is leaving The Guardian to start a new venture with eBay co-founder Pierre Omidyar. It's interesting to see internet billionaires put money into journalism. A couple of months ago, Amazon's Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post for $250 million, and I guess Omidyar was also approached by the Washington Post. This new venture is called NewCo. What do you think about this?
Well, you know, that one sort of went under my radar during this whole battle, and I didn't even actually know who was behind the financing of it, although I did see some news about Glenn Greenwald getting a really big backer. And you know, on the one hand, it's terrific that really rich people want to put money into real journalism, and I think you could say fearless journalism on the part of Mr. Greenwald. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, don't you kind of wonder, you know, what their own personal interests are and what sort of transparency will be behind that you can look at?
I think there's always a danger, and you look at ProPublica, which has done phenomenal work and really has become a force to be reckoned with. But for a segment of the population, it will always be something that has a lot of money from George Soros in it. And because of who the backer is, who
ProPublica is Soros?
Well, he has.
I thought it was okay.
It's not true. I mean, it's not his organization, but the fact that by association, because he's one of the investors in the startup. The right has made it into, you know, an organization that can't be trusted, and it came up in the IRS hearings constantly. How did ProPublica get their hands on this taxpayer information? Well, of course, because George Soros had funded them, and it, you know, it becomes an urban legend. So I think there is a risk when you get out of kind of traditional mainstream media into a media that has different funding sources. You run that risk of reputational association, I guess.
So do you think these tech wizards can save journalism? What do you think are some of the pros and cons of celebrity ownership? You know, there's historical context, certainly. Hearst at the turn of the last century.
Or Pulitzer.
Exactly.
It's not always a good thing. But at the same time, some of those crusading journalists and privately owned endeavors did a lot of good work. I mean, I think the Washington Post was privately owned for a really long time and did lots of great stuff, but it's not quite the same as having a billionaire or multimillionaire run an outfit. I mean, I used to work for the New York Daily News. That's run by a billionaire real estate man named Mort Zuckerman. You know, he didn't really mess with the editorial product very much, but, you know, there was always a lingering suspicion that there was a right-wing sort of pro-business bias in there. So you have to figure out how to run those traps by doing good journalism, I guess.
And yeah. So my understanding of ProPublica is that It was founded by the former Wall Street Journal editor, Paul Steiger. And then it's really funded by the San Francisco, the local Herbert and Marion Sandler.
Well,
they gave, $10 million, I think.
On their website, I'm pretty sure Soros had some investment in there initially to help it get kick-started. But, you know, again, I'm not making that link. I don't think they take orders from George Soros in any way. But because you have who your investors are, people can accuse you of that. And you can see that in the Wall Street Journal with Rupert Murdoch and his own ownership of the Wall Street Journal. Some people claim there's no change. Some people say it's a completely different publication. I personally think maybe the focus has changed on how they report an article a little bit, actually probably in a good way. And the editorial pages aren't, you know, known for what they are, editorial pages. That's, you know, you're welcome to say whatever you want on the editorial page as long as it doesn't cloud your coverage. And you know, but I think some people will look at the Wall Street Journal now as a vehicle of Murdoch and by guilt of his ownership.
And Omidyar is already running the Honolulu Civil Beat, and he's got a lot of investments in Hawaii. My understanding is that his political background is that he's libertarian bent.
Rand Paul endorsement can't be far away then.
Yeah.
So let's talk now about the shutdown and the debt ceiling crisis. For the past couple of weeks, we've been in constant crisis mode, and very much most of media coverage has been centered on Washington. What do you think about how major media outlets framed this crisis? Why don't we start with you, Kevin?
Well, I think it is what it is. I mean, there's now an attempt to suggest that, well, the media didn't cover it right because they didn't look at the president's role in this, or that they somehow allowed him to stand free of it. And I don't think that's, you know, if you understand the separation of powers, you can argue, well, maybe he should have tried to bring the people together more or whatever. But, you know, there's a political calculation on all sides. And obviously this started by a group of lawmakers that chose to shut down the government. But it does take two chambers, and they did not, they had not had a budget conference committee since 2009, so there's plenty of blame to go around. It's a structure, kind of a continuing march from about 2003 forward that led us to this. I mean, but it certainly was a conscious choice by one chamber of the Congress.
And what would you add, Michael? You also cover Congress, and now that the crisis is over, it seems like most media, the dominant narrative seems to be that the far right and the Republican Party overplayed its hand and lost politically as a result. But I kind of wonder if the concessions from Democrats about spending and health care, well, not health care so much, but about spending and to negotiate over Social Security, et cetera, is, you know, did the Tea Party strategy work in some ways?
Well, I don't know if you can really argue that it did, because the concessions that Democrats were willing to make, they were willing to make before there was a government shutdown. You know, when you start talking about the entitlement reform, change CPI, you know, lowering the COLAs and Social Security and Medicare and things like that, that's something that President Obama put on the table. And the spending levels that they agreed to in this short-term extension, they're really what they agreed to, I'd say, in the beginning of September. And their sequestration level, if that means anything to folks, it's the budget number that Republicans have been insisting that Democrats adhere to. And Democrats were willing to go along with that because they thought, well, here's our compromise, and this is the way we might perhaps avoid even worse fight.
Tell us what that means, Michael.
Well, what it means is, you know, the last time we had a showdown, 2011, they passed the Budget Control Act, which said we have to cut a certain amount of money, and then sequestration, which is you have to cut more if you don't get to another, what was it, $1.2 trillion in debt reduction. And that's what we're living under. And you get these automatic cuts every year, or at least they specify the slowing rate of growth in the budget. And Democrats passed a budget in the Senate for the first time in, I think, 4 years, that said, okay, we would like to live by a slightly higher number. We want to undo sequestration, and we want to shift around, you know, what gets cut and what doesn't. That didn't fly in the House. Obviously, they're trying to keep to the much lower number. So in order to broker this deal early on, they said, okay, we'll take this lower number, and I believe it's about, if it were a whole year, it would be about $986 billion if you spread it out over the whole year. Democrats wanted $1.058 trillion, I think. So they chopped, if it were over a whole year, more than $70 billion off of what they wanted in order to get the short-term deal. It's just a short-term deal. So that was sort of their early-on compromise. And they didn't even really tout it as a compromise. So you sort of lost that in the debate. It was the Democrats won't negotiate. They won't compromise.
Well, I wonder what both of you think is the reason that after 16 days they finally did hold a vote and come to this sort of temporary solution. Why do you think that happened? And I guess to piggyback on that, what do you think is the power and the interests of the financial industry? It seems like these uncertainties can't be good for the economy. Are there people in the business class that are trying to influence the political battles in D.C., and is that part of the reason that this finally came to an end? What do you think was the turning point?
Well, I think the turning point was the fact that the debt ceiling was being reached. Well, not just the debt ceiling, but the Treasury's ability to, you know, sort of shift money around and keep the bills paid. The business community, as you say, was very clear that they didn't want to see that breached. The Chamber of Commerce, which is usually very conservative, was telling members of Congress, don't do this. The Business Roundtable, which also very conservative, telling them, don't do this. And I think that Speaker Boehner was walking a very fine line of trying to listen to his members, many of whom are very conservative and wanted to push it as far as they could. And the business community was saying, well, don't go over the line. So what we wound up with is right up to the line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And unfortunately, you know, from my vantage point as an economics correspondent, you know, the president is absolutely right that it's a self-inflicted wound. And we saw in 2011, in the aftermath of that, we saw how badly consumer confidence dipped, how it translated into lower sales, you know, just as the economy is kind of hitting steam. And, you know, why we would choose to do this over something. And, you know, I can understand if you strongly feel that the ACA is such a bad piece of legislation that it's going to harm the economy, I can understand why you would take steps to try to do things, if that's really your legitimate viewpoint. But to argue that it's, you know, it's so important to do that, to put the economy at risk, to put the full faith and credit of the nation at risk, and basically our standing in the world. I mean, I think the China editorial, while it was only in English and designed to score points, basically, was a valid one. At some point, people get tired of the rest of the world having to suffer our squabbling, and it has affected money. If you combine that with the Federal Reserve and whether or not it's going to taper back on its purchases of bonds, that is causing money to come in and out of emerging markets. It's really having an effect on real people's lives in countries around the world, and it is leading to a resentment of U.S. policymakers and, by default, the U.S.
And that's Kevin Hall. He's the chief economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. He's in D.C. We're also joined by Michael McAuliffe, who's the senior congressional correspondent for the Huffington Post. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. And let me invite our listeners to join our discussion about the week's news. And we're particularly focusing on the crisis in D.C., the default that was averted, and the shutdown of the government. What do you think about the coverage of the partial shutdown? Did you get enough news about the actual effects? Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you have a shout-out to a reporter or a news outlet that did a particularly good job covering news this week, let us know, 866-798-8255. 5-5. And do you feel like coverage of important public interest stories was left out because of such a big focus this week, the dominance of this narrative of what was happening in Washington? Again, give us a call at 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. So Kevin, you were just talking about the economic consequences of the potential of the debt default and the shutdown. Can you guys tell us what were the actual costs of the shutdown and whether the potential to default, what were the economic consequences of that? Why don't we start with you, Kevin?
Yeah, I think the number kind of floating around is $24 billion, and correct me, Michael, if I'm wrong on that, but I think that's the number that we've seen. And just as in 95, 96, there was a cost, you know, whether it's loss, salary, you know, people being paid for, a lot that goes into that, people being paid to not work and things of that sort. There's a cost in the higher borrowing costs that we incurred as the cost to borrow, you know, for the government. The six-month bond was having the same yield, basically an over 1 week treasury bill was having the same yield or interest rate that the government has to pay as a six-month bond, so people were, it was costing the United States to borrow more. I mean, that's another direct cost. The cost to products that are the FCC is needs to approve a bunch of electronics that for use for sale over Christmas. That some of that stuff may not make it before Christmas. Food inspection, any number of things. So, Michael, you want to jump in on some more?
Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, well, I think that $24 billion estimate was lost economic activity, and I think Fitch came out with that one. And it seemed pretty reasonable to most of the folks I spoke to. And if I remember, the Congressional Research Service did a study of, like, direct costs to the federal government for the last one, and that was something in the neighborhood of $1.5 billion, but the federal government's bigger now. Inflation has occurred, so I bet you that's probably on the order of $3 or $4 billion this time around. So, and I bet you there'll be all kinds of studies that try to figure out, you know, what the cost was. I mean, I saw some reporting over the course of the thing that said that usually the, you know, sort of overall economic activity in a shutdown drops and then it rebounds. So maybe long term it won't be terrible. I don't know.
Quarter you'll have some bounce back because those federal workers who weren't spending money will get their checks and then go out and spend that money. So you get, some of that will get back. But there's stuff that's harder to measure. For instance, this, you know, the knockdown in consumer confidence, knowing that we have a budget deadline of January 15th and another debt ceiling of February 7th, you know, are people going to say, you know, well, I'm not sure my job's secure, this is still going on, so they may not spend more over Christmas. Someone who's thinking of buying a new car might drive that car 1 year longer, see how this all shakes out. So I think there are costs that are harder to calculate but are very real.
You know, I can actually, there's probably something that might be a little bit reassuring to folks about that February 7th deadline, and that is in the way that this deal was done, there were Republicans who wanted to prevent the Treasury Department from taking the sorts of extraordinary measures that it has since May in terms of shuffling money around, not paying certain pension funds so they keep those bills paid. The Senate deal, which ended up passing, doesn't prohibit any of those extraordinary measures. So between now and February 7th, you can pretty much bank on the Treasury Department trying to fill all the little accounts that it raided and undo all the extraordinary things that it did to keep the government running. So when we hit February 7th, if they've done all that, you'll actually have probably another 2 or 3 or 4 months before we're in danger of defaulting again. So there's at least that silver lining.
That's Michael McAuliffe is the senior congressional correspondent for the Huffington Post. We're also joined by Kevin Hall, who is the chief economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We're going to be right back after this short break.
All of the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org. Do you have a story that was reported thoughtfully this week? Share it with us by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, or you can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Thank you.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and find out what's coming up next. On Monday, we're going to have a conversation about sharks. October is Shark Awareness Month, and we're going to talk about how our fate may be very much tied to theirs. Some shark populations have declined as much as 80% in the last decade, and they're approaching extinction. So what can we do to help reverse the decline of the shark populations? That's on Monday. And on Tuesday, we're going to take a look at the check cashing and payday lending industry. Why do people use them? Who's profiting? And are there alternatives for people closed out of traditional banking? That'll be on Tuesday with Rose Aguilar. Today, we're talking about coverage of the week's news and particularly the partial government shutdown and the default, potential default that was averted just before the deadline on October 16th, yesterday. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can call us at 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number to join our conversation, 866-798-8255. We're joined today by Michael McAuliffe, the senior congressional correspondent for the Huffington Post, and Kevin Hall, who's the chief economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. And before the break, we were talking about the economic effects of the government shutdown and the threat to default on the nation's debt. In the Washington Post, Simone Campbell writes that most of us have been dismayed by the media coverage of the government shutdown, which has too rarely focused on its impact on those already struggling families in our nation. And the article mentions particularly Head Start, energy assistance, public housing, and child welfare services. So do you guys want to just talk before we go to callers? We've got a lot of people on the line that I want to get to. A little bit more about how this shutdown affected some of the most vulnerable in the U.S., yeah. Michael? Oh, go ahead. Well,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I guess, you know, we're different animals. McClatchy has a chain. You know, we have 30 papers, and then we have 400 or so that use our copy as well. So out of our bureau, we did focus initially on those areas where the poor were going to be hit the hardest, and we did focus on folks who, you know, when you think about the people who were deemed non-essential, those were the people with the lower salaries in the government scale. They were secretaries and administrative assistants and people like that who have, you know, the least financial wherewithal to withstand 16 days of no pay. So I think there was a lot of attention on that, and I know our individual papers then localized a lot of these stories. So I do think in the newspaper coverage, It was there. I can, you know, Michael can speak more to the internet world, but and TV, I'm sure, has the limit of 90 seconds to tell the story as well.
Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, well, it's one of our favorite things is to try and figure out how it affects people. So we always try to do that. And since it was such a broad scale event, I think most outlets did actually try to look at that in this particular case, where a lot of times you don't necessarily hear it, and especially around here. I'm in D.C., so I get the coverage from Maryland and Virginia, and there are so many government workers and so many government contractors that you see a lot of it. But now, one story I haven't heard that much is that all the people who work for the government are at least going to get their back pay, but people who were furloughed or laid off through contractors, there's no remedy for them. They're just out that money, so there are a lot of them around here.
Yeah, I've got several friends who are in that boat, and they're not real happy.
And let's go to a caller. Mark in Berkeley, welcome to your call.
Thank you. I wanted to mention that in Paul Krugman's column today, he goes back to 2010 and refers to these ideologues and their policies as crisis-ridden economics. And he cites this study that adds up $700 billion in losses as a result of people like Cruz, Smith, the Republican strategy people. And it's so destructive, and there needs to be, obviously, a shift because, for all the reasons that your guests have brought up. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Mark. Do you guys want to talk to that? And I wonder, you know, he's talking about there needs to be a shift from these destructive politics. Does the public have a long-term memory for this stuff, or are we just going to move to the next story?
I think this one will stick around for a little bit longer, although I do have to admit that in election cycle time, we're so early into the next cycle, I'm not 100% convinced that folks will remember it. But there is one thing that gives me a little bit of hope, and he mentioned, I think, 2010 as the start for the sort of crisis-driven politics. I mean, they've been, when I say they, I mean sort of the really right-wing Republicans have been angling for this fight for really 3 years. They've been saying our really big piece of leverage to get Obamacare is going to be, you know, holding the debt limit hostage. And they've been pretty forthright in saying that for all this time. But here it came. They did it, and it didn't work. And they took a beating in the polls. So you can perhaps be somewhat hopeful that you will not see this crisis again in January and February. So there is that. It didn't work.
They took a beating in the polls, but you also say that they're raising record numbers of money.
That doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get reelected, does it?
Yeah,
it's the gerrymandering that's tougher there.
Yeah, yeah.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Michael hit on something that's very important, that the folks who were driving this are people who are in extremely safe districts who don't have much of a, either from the left or from the moderate side, have much of a competition. So they're free to run as fast and as far as they want. I think one of the things that was a very interesting story that I could have equally pointed out is the story of the week. Wall Street Journal had a very good front page story on big business rethinking who it gives money to. And some of these guys had received money because they won their primary. They got money from business simply because they weren't Democrats. And I think the business roundtable and these big interest groups for multinationals and big banks, they're now rethinking that strategy, that maybe someone who's so far to the right isn't a better alternative than a Democrat. So one of the things they say clearly is they're going to look to fund the moderates who are there now, who face a challenge to their further right flank, or people who might emerge to challenge some of these people to the right, so that the money game is changing a bit, and it'll be interesting to watch next year.
That's Kevin Hall. He's chief economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. We're also joined by Michael McAuliffe, who's the senior congressional correspondent for the Huffington Post. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're going to put a link to all of these articles at yourcallradio.org. We've got a lot of callers, and I want to get to Michelle from San Francisco. Welcome to Your Call.
Thank you. My question is, I'm one of those people that sometimes politics and government and constitutional law gets kind of boring and challenging, but now I'm really riveted. And has there been enough talk about why John Boehner would not bring this important decision to the House, which doesn't seem legal? It doesn't seem right that he should be able to hold back a legitimate vote because he knows he doesn't have enough of votes going his way. And can that law be changed, and do people understand that?
Well, thanks, Michelle. Let's put that to Michael and Kevin. So the votes were always there if they had just had a straight up and down vote, but Boehner was trying to get something that the Republicans could pass.
Yeah.
Can that be changed, and can you explain what happened there for us?
Well, it can be changed, but I don't think that in the House that the party in power would want to do it there. There has been some interest in the Senate in changing those rules because the minority has been tying things up to a greater extent probably than in history. I mean, it's gotten worse with each new party in power over the last decade at least. But right now it's continued the trend. It's been gridlock, as we all know, in Congress for the last few years. So in order to change the rules, the guys who are in power have to want to change the rules. And in the House, I don't think they have any interest in doing that whatsoever. In the Senate, they kind of do, except that they're a little bit worried that what happens when we're in the minority the next time. So they don't necessarily want to do too much there. But it's still simmering under the surface.
Kevin, do you think that aspect of this so-called crisis got enough coverage? As somebody who's just a member of the general public, you know, reads media and watches media a lot, I don't feel like that was covered all that much. It felt like there's this political stalemate and, you know, nothing can happen because they don't agree, when we could have had a vote any time.
Well, it's the Speaker's prerogative, and I'm not sure how much, I mean, what I wrestle with as a journalist is how much minutia does the public want? And, you know, if it were me making that call, I would wonder how much do people want to really know about the power dynamics of, you know, the speaker versus the majority leader, you know, is Cantor up or down versus, you know, it's the kind of thing you probably do as a post-mortem after the fact, you know, how, you know, everybody, one of the things, the stories that I saw afterwards was stories that looked at, you know, everybody was talking up Boehner even in the loss, because if he goes, nobody wants his job. It's an it's a thankless job. You can't. You've got a fractured party. I mean, Republicans today are kind of the Democrats of old. They don't have a single. They had a much narrower constituency than they do now, and now they have the same kind of fractured interests that Democrats always have had and have had to cobble together. So I think that's. Michael can correct me if I'm wrong. He's closer to this stuff than I am, but I do think the kind of the internal nature of the Republican Party is changing, and I think that's what they're wrestling with. And you look at, you know, the outside players, the Chris Christies, the Rand Pauls, the Marco Rubios, and how each one of them played, what they did or didn't say throughout this process speaks to how fractured the party is.
And let me go to more of the public to hear how people are viewing this coverage, what they want more of, and put the question that Kevin had, which is how much minutia does the public want in coverage of these issues? Our number is 866-798-TALK. It's our weekly media roundtable on your call. The number again is toll-free, 866-798-8255. And let's go to Linda in Santa Cruz. Hi, Linda.
Good morning. I do think it is a bit of minutia that I will always remember Ted Cruz reading his story, bedtime story to his kids at night when he held up this on the Senate floor. And I see this as a problem. It's a big problem in our country now. I think when our founders wrote our original documents, I'm sure they always had spoiled brats to deal with, but I think we have more spoiled brats than ever. And that someone like Cruz is so out of touch, he feels content and even entitled to read his children a good night story while there is so much suffering going on. There are so many people losing so much, so many jobs at loss, and he did this. I just think that there's not a better picture for the problems where these grown men really behave like victims, and they're victims to themselves, and yet they bring everyone else down. And I'm kind of sick of this. I think some of this is media-driven because they are like personalities all on their own, and this is why they do it. So on one hand, yes, I suppose we need to see things like this, and yet on the other hand, it doesn't seem to matter how badly behaved they are. They still keep going.
Well, the cameras are a big part of it. This is Kevin, and you know, I noticed one of the things when the deal was when McConnell was announcing the deal on the floor. I watch CNBC television most of the day for what I do for a living, and suddenly they cut away from McConnell's floor speech laying out the compromise and went to Ted Cruz coming out. And you know, Cruz is not a dummy. He knew that his minority leader was on the floor talking about the deal, and he undercut him, you know, which is a pretty big breach of protocol politically. But it also, you know, spoke to the degree to which, you know, the cameras kind of feed this sort of thing. But, you know, I'm less pessimistic. I'm old enough to remember that the Democrats, before they got to Bill Clinton, went through a 10-year period where they, you know, the unions were a big issue and who controlled them. Mondale wasn't sure how to deal with the Big Tent. Dukakis was a disaster. And the Democratic Party had to work through this. The Republican Party would do the same thing. They've always been, for lack of a better word, carnival barkers, kind of these media hog-type guys. Each party's had them. But the system tends to neutralize them eventually. And I think that will probably happen again. Michael, you're probably closer to this than I am.
Yeah, well, it's true. You're right. It does sort of go in these cycles and things like that. But I've been sort of, every once in a while, I get to hear some historians talk about the level of dysfunction in Washington and in Congress in particular. And even by historical standards, you know, you go way back and you had duels, you know, and people carrying weapons on the floor of the House. The overall dysfunction now, sort of by historical standards, is actually worse. So
that's what we keep hearing. Let's go to more callers. Letitia in San Mateo, welcome to your call.
Hi. I'm calling because I noticed that we talked about the federal workers and their assistants not being able to get paid, and then a few other people trickled down. But then here in the West and Midwest, we've had floods, we had firestorms, and then sometimes double firestorms.
Mm.
And these are the people that are really suffering. And the one that sticks in my mind is a lady in Yosemite. I think she was a single mother, and in 2 weeks lost her business because of all this foolishness. And I think you guys talk about, or the media talks about the upper hand, and then they talk about the middle people a little bit. But, man, the people on the lower end of the totem pole, we sure don't get talked about at all. And
so, Letitia, you'd like to hear more stories about the sort of how the people at the lower end of the economic rung are faring.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's sickening. I've heard so many people lose their business. And you know, I'm on disability, and I would have been one of the people who wouldn't have gotten a check November 1st. And I still didn't care as much as the people that lost their businesses or people that are hungry, things like that. I mean,
kids in Head Start.
It's abominable what happened.
Well, let's
maybe each of them should take a piece of their check and give it back to these people so they can get back their businesses, because all they're going to do is go back home, and they're going to get a smack on their wrist from their constituents or a hurrah. And meanwhile, these people still don't have a business or a house or whatever.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Letitia. Go ahead.
Just
Kevin.
A quick, real brief comment. You know, one of the big problems, and it's a Democrat and Republican problem, is the gerrymandering, where you know where the party in charge of a state then carves up the district so you get protected seats. And I'm not an advocate of term limits, because I think you know Mexico tried term limits and it actually increased corruption, not decreased it. But I do think, you know, a big part of the problem is the way, when you can carve up districts where you don't have competitive elections, then you get people who don't have consequences, and that is a problem.
And let's go to Molly in Berkeley. Hi, Molly. Welcome to your call.
Hello. Thank you very much. I would like to object, actually, to the reference of to minutia in the workings of the Congress. I think it's very important for the public to understand what the daily lives of members of Congress are like, and that it does matter who is in control of the House or the Senate, and how they treat the opposition or the minority. It's very important for the body politic to become as aware as possible of the workings of the Congress.
Yeah, so, if I can clarify, I wasn't saying that we shouldn't report it. I was saying that I struggle wondering how much detail the public wants and to what degree what is too much. But I certainly don't. I agree wholeheartedly, and I appreciate the comments.
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, it sounds like what people who are calling are saying, they want to
give
know. They want to know more. Yeah, give us the minutia.
Uh-huh.
Let's go to Arnie in San Rafael. Hi, Arnie.
Hi, good morning. Hey, would you please discuss the earmarks that were attached to the bill, specifically in which apparently Mitch McConnell benefited from a huge public works project in Ohio or on the Tennessee-Ohio border. So there was a lot of money attached to this bill. Simply wasn't a let's start up the government and let's raise the debt ceiling. So could you talk about earmarks?
Yeah, I'm eager to hear about it. Tell us about the earmarks.
Well, I knew I should have looked into this a little bit more carefully before I came on, because I had a feeling it would be a question. But I did look a little bit, and as far as I can tell, these things were mostly stuff that would have been done, had to get done at some point anyway. I think that the Kentucky-Tennessee thing was a big, some sort of flood control water project that had been sitting there ready to go, and they used this and they stuck it on. And as far as I can tell, it wasn't McConnell who did it. It may have been Dianne Feinstein and Lamar Alexander. And were they saying thanks for brokering a deal? Maybe. I don't know. But it seems like something that actually had to get done. And just to give you a small example, there is a $174,000 payment that was attached to this bill to the widow of Senator Frank Lautenberg, who just died recently. And like, why? And he was a very wealthy man. So why is a $174,000 know, payment being made to the widow of this wealthy man. Well, it's something that has been done for a very long time, and they usually attach it to the first legislative vehicle that comes along. So that got stuck in there because this was a piece of business that was happening. So some of those things might not actually be pure earmarks. You have to look very carefully.
Anything you want to add to that, Kevin?
Just to quote a famous movie line, I wish I could quit you.
And, you know, Mike, just one other question that Molly brought up about how Congress works and wanting to hear more of that. Are there any stories that you really, really want people to know about, angles on Congress, the fact that there's so many millionaires, that we have a very wealthy political class? Is there anything that you feel like you just don't get to write about because it is considered too much minutia, or are there frustrations in kind of what you think people want?
Well, I try to write about this occasionally, and I would like to do it more, but there are many, many, many bills, and it's been happening a lot with the various funding bills where the priorities cut the sorts of things that provide us information, whether it's the census, whether it's inspectors general, whether it's various science agencies or Department of Energy programs, things that provide real hard data and understanding. It's much worse in the House than it is in the Senate, but the Senate often will go along to make a deal, and you end up depriving the public of information. There isn't as much money going into the census as most folks who study things having to do with the census think that it really needs in order to do a good job.
Yeah. One of the things that I also think the public would probably find more interesting that we don't do enough of, because there is a certain feeling that people are tired of politics, but in a brinksmanship exercise like this, they're the people who exercise power and they're the people who want to exercise power, and I personally just find it fascinating how people like someone like a Paul Ryan, you know, very late in the process, came with an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that was supposedly showing kind of the big path forward if we could get agreement on these things, and their agreement on all these things. So he kind of stayed above the fray, got his image out as a reformer, and then suddenly when he's on the budget committee, now he's on the budget conference, which is negotiating, and suddenly now it's, well, we can't do big things. We have very different plans. And so now, you know, it becomes an election platform, and so much of what happens in Washington is window dressing for things that people are trying to push further down the road, and I think there was a lot of that, and maybe we'll have it later in the postmortem. I don't know if that qualifies as too much or not enough minutia, but I do think there are so many interests that Mitch McConnell, for instance, had faced a challenge from the Tea Party and the right, so he's been moving to the right. But now the latest poll shows that in all this, he's now safe. It seems to have more or less vanquished his Tea Party opponent, but now he's trailing in the polls to his Democratic challenger because of this whole flap.
And we have a lot of questions and comments at our website, which is yourcallradio.org. You can put comments and continue the discussion there. We'll have links to all of the articles that we're talking about. I'm going to try and sneak in one final call. John in Santa Cruz, welcome to your call.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It just seems to me that using the threat of default on the U.S. debt to try to get your way about anything is just wrong. And it seems to me the media has framed the issue as both sides are to blame and the truth is somewhere in between. Well, that's just not true.
Yeah, I it does seem like that's very much, it's this political showdown, and that's why the government is shut down. What do you think about that narrative, Mike and Kevin?
Well, in this particular instance, I don't have any problem saying that it was the Republicans and the Tea Party who caused the showdown, who brought it on, and who finally bowed down and let it end. But to just to bring back something, and this is minutia again, that Kevin mentioned earlier, there hasn't been a budget in Washington, D.C. since, I think, 2009. And the reason that's a problem is because the budget, once it's passed by Congress, it tells the appropriators, right, more minutia, how much money they have to spend for each part of the government. So they can negotiate a budget, or not a budget, an appropriation, and they can pass it. And then you don't have this continuing resolution fight at the end of the fiscal year to keep the government open because they've actually passed the money already in the normal, regular process.
And Kevin, let me go to you. We're running against the clock here, but what happens now in January? What are they supposed to negotiate over? And are we going to be doomed to these endless cycles of political crises again and again?
No, I mean, I think what the more likely occurrence is that our continuing resolution to fund the government runs out January 15th, and absent some new one, the Budget Control Act kind of kicks into force and we have more sequester. I think what we're going to find is some tweaks to that. I think, you know, enough people with military bases or military contractors in their districts understand that a $50 billion hit to that sector is going to hurt a lot of their constituents. So I think they'll find enough common ground on areas where their common constituents are being hurt. But I wouldn't expect much more. And you know, the sequester, which was sold as so onerous and draconian that there's no way they could let it take effect, is clearly going to be the rule of the roost for at least a couple more years.
And Michael, you get the last word. You get 15 seconds.
Well, there is a budget conference. They're going to do one. And if they can actually get together and pass those, set those appropriations levels, you might not have a showdown. But, you know, I'm not that hopeful.
Well, thank you both for joining us. We've been speaking with Michael McAuliffe, who's senior congressional correspondent for the Huffington Post, and Kevin Hall, who's chief economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. We'll put a link to their articles and all of the articles that we talked about at yourcallradio.org. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody who emailed and called. I apologize that we couldn't get to all of you. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Should we learn to love sharks? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the rapid depletion of one of the world's top predators. According to a new study, the world's shark population is experiencing significant decline, with perhaps 100 million or more sharks being lost every year. What can we do to help reverse the decline of shark populations? How is our fate tied to theirs? Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcasts, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also friend us on Facebook. Ali Budner and Malihe Razazan produced the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is the chief engineer. Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.